so I'd swim back and forth to swirl it all around. By early summer, the pool would be 50-50 cold and hot. Near the end of the filming season, by early fall, the pool would morph into a low-grade jacuzzi and recused itself from providing relief. Not a cool spot to be felt. The house Ida and I rented was the same way. Everything was fine in March, but 5 months later the heat would become inexorably trapped in its bowels. I decided to adopt an admittedly strange ritual of, quote, bleeding the water pipes. Convinced that the superheated water was trapped in the pipes because of subpar wall insulation, and I think I'm right, I'd run the cold water until it actually got cold again. The production schedule for Burn Notice had us shooting during the low tourist season, which ironically was summer in Miami. Summer is usually associated with sun, fun, and vacations, but the peak of Miami's tourism and tolerability was during the winter. Much like we did when we were kids, people head south for the winter. December, January, and February are the perfect months to be in Miami. September and October are the perilous hurricane months, and anything in between took place at its own peril. Shooting is always easier when it's not crowded. Productions have better chance of filming at popular restaurants, landmarks, or recreation areas, and you don't have as many gawkers coagulating around you. Whenever I worked in New Zealand, the weather was flip-flop because I'd crossed the equator into the southern hemisphere. If I went down in June, the beginning of my summer, the New Zealand winter was just coming on full force. I would return home to fall weather, realizing that the entire season had passed me by. Some years, depending on when I went and how long I stayed, experiencing back-to-back summers or winters was not unusual, just completely discombobulating. Spending my summer and fall in Miami meant that I only had about one good month of weather in Florida before the inferno began. By the time I got back to Oregon, I'd only have a few weeks until the weather turned into stereotypical Pacific Northwest, cold and wet. For 7 years, it seemed like I was never anywhere at the right time. On Notice. My role in Burn Notice was that of Sam Axe, a former Navy SEAL. I was informed to never use the term X when referring to military service. After serving honorably, Sam was now devoted to a life of women, suds, and sun. However, fate would deal him a different card when friend and spy Michael Weston gets burned by a mysterious organization and shows up in Miami with nothing. Created by boyish, whip-smart Matt Nix, Burn Notice raced from pilot to production and became a 7-season hit for the USA Network, arguably influencing the network template for new shows over the next few years. It's also inarguably one of the most successful, challenging, and rewarding projects I've ever been a part of. I didn't know Jeffrey Donovan before Burn Notice. He was almost exactly 10 years younger than me, but had 15 years of experience under his belt in theater, movies, and television. Jeffrey and I bonded over the fact that I had been in his shoes before, starring in two previous TV shows or, as we would joke, being number one on the call sheet. Jeffrey was a very accomplished, dynamic actor, and the show is a perfect vehicle for his unique gifts. Eventually, he became like a younger brother to me, and our relationship remained strong throughout. Gabrielle Anwar was an old pro by the time Burn Notice rolled around. Having acted since childhood, she was confident in her abilities and was wonderfully frank and direct on set in her dealings with directors and producers. I enjoyed her toughness and general fearlessness. Gabrielle had just finished a stint on The Tudors, a decidedly highbrow affair, and Burn Notice couldn't have been a bigger departure. She loved calling it a silly boys show and seemed genuinely baffled by what made the show so popular. Sharon Gless was a TV icon, having achieved deserved accolades on her groundbreaking show Cagney and Lacey. I'm continually amused by actors who are, in reality, the opposite of the characters they portray. In the show, Madeline Weston, my character called her Maddie, was a life-hardened battle axe with strong opinions. In real life, Sharon was a pussycat. I would even call her shy and slightly demure. Now granted, she could laugh like a longshoreman and had a wonderful bawdy sense of humor, but I was always dumbfounded how a multiple Emmy winner could still be so questioning of her own abilities. Kobe Bell, my personal salvation in Miami, rolled in for season 4 and beyond as the character Jesse. Kobe, although 20 years my junior, had done 6 seasons of Third Watch and a slew of other television. He was unfazed, or so it seemed, by coming into the show, late in the party, to take some heat off the rest of us. Kobe's a mensch, a father of 4 young children. He would dutifully fly back to Los Angeles every weekend without fail. I'll always be impressed by that. As a younger actor, I never had that dedication, and it damaged my first marriage. Kobe and I became fast friends. I think the writers sensed this because Sam and Jesse were often paired together in scenes apart from Michael or Fiona. Aside from the regulars, we got terrific support seasonally from Seth Peterson as Michael's tormented brother, Stephen Martinez as Fiona's ill-fated lover, and the unsung work of journeyman actors Mark McCauley and Brandon Morris, who played a couple of by-the-book FBI guys. One of the great things about a hit TV show is that it attracts high-quality guest stars. Usually, actors will flock to a TV show for one of 2 reasons. Either they're fans, or it's popular. As 7 seasons rolled out, Burn Notice benefited from both criteria, and over 500 actors passed through Miami. Because this was an international spy show, this varied group of thespians fell into some of the obvious categories. For starters, you need an endless string of bad guys to defeat. Playing a bad guy appeals to many actors, mostly because they don't have to be likable and they can ham it up. John Mahoney, who played the cryptic management guy, was a fan of the show. Jay Carnes and Todd Stashwick were both good at being smooth bad guys. Jerry Burns specialized in creepy. A handful of Briscoe alumni even snuck in to play baddies, MC Gainey, Andrew Devoff, and John Piper Ferguson. Trisha Helfer, an early bad S, was both beautiful and dangerous. Certainly the most colorful bad guy award would have to go to Tim Matheson for his portrayal of Larry, the rogue operative. Tim was an old pro who had been in the business forever, and I respected him a lot. Hell, he did the voice for Johnny Quest, my favorite cartoon as a kid. Tim also returned in the director's chair to lead us through a number of our most epic season-ending episodes. Aside from the overtly bad, spy shows also need a layer of not good, not bad characters. We had plenty of very questionable CIA types who excelled at doublespeak. Richard Schiff, Alex Carter, and the formidable John C. McGinley were all standouts. My favorite of the CIA jerks, though, were 2 numbskulls, played by Brandon O'Malley and John Ailes. These characters were imported from the Sam Axe TV movie, and as actors we loved shouting at each other. Often after the camera would cut, we'd all burst out laughing. Eventually, you work your way into the mostly good guys. Barry the money launderer, a recurring character, was wonderfully played by Paul Tay. I always look forward to scenes with him. Paul had a great sense of humor, and the two of us came as close to ad-libbing as there was on the show, which wasn't a whole lot. Jack Coleman, Grant Show, and Lawrence DeMille capably headed up the more serious accomplices. There was also quite an array of maybe good, maybe bad leading ladies for Jeffrey to play opposite, such as Moon Bloodgood, Dina Meyer, and Alona Tal. I managed to spend screen time with Kristanna Loken in a couple episodes, and I didn't complain one little bit. If you stay on the air long enough, plenty of random casting will happen, too, where you get people who are perfectly fine for the role, but who already had impressive careers of their own, like warrior princess Lucy Lawless, singer Gavin Rossdale, football great Michael Irvin, comedy freak Patton Oswalt, WWE legend Big Show, and rapper Method Man. Of all the guest stars on Burn Notice, the most awe-inspiring was the bandit himself, Mr. Burt Reynolds. A lot of our Florida-based production team had worked with Burt on various movies and TV shows, and they talked him into appearing in an episode. Writing about a guy like Burt Reynolds, where do you even begin? Not only was he a fellow Michigander, but in addition to Burt's acting career, well past the half-century mark now, encompassed the end of the studio system, early television, and the Hollywood blockbuster. Burt was the #1 box office star for 5 years running, which is unparalleled. At his peak, he declined the roles of James Bond and Han Solo. His contributions to cinema and television really are iconic. In my profession, we would be lucky to have 1 Deliverance, or The Longest Yard, on our resume. My contemporaries on the small screen would be thrilled to be associated with just one classic like Gunsmoke or Evening Shade. The man's accomplishments are various and impressive. He founded a theater, posed naked in Cosmopolitan magazine, and had a hit single called Let's Do Something Cheap and Superficial. He's got an Emmy, some Golden Globes, and a sack full of People's Choice Awards. From spaghetti westerns to boogie nights, what hasn't this guy done? When I first met Bert, it was during a lunch break on set. We heard a rumor that the man himself was in the building for a visit. Jeffrey and I rode up on our set bikes, and I executed a classic backpedal skid stop. I looked up to see Bert smiling, and I decided to try my usual, "Hey, buddy, this is a closed set," routine, pretending not to recognize him. Thankfully, Bert ate it up, and we quickly established an easy rapport. During the run of Bert's episode, we got to socialize a couple times. One night at the Forge, a Miami institution, Bert explained one of the worst things about being a male sex symbol: encountering drunk female fans. "You'd think it would be really fun," he explained. "Hot chicks throwing themselves at you, but not if they're drunk. Then it's really horrible. They'd wrap their legs around you and never let go." Bert did a great job in the episode. His charm and charisma still evident, even after way too recent heart surgery knocked him for a loop. Before the series ended, Ida and I wanted to see Bert one last time, so we scheduled a trip up to his home in Jupiter, Florida. Valhalla, Bert's name for his oceanfront estate, was befitting of the icon. Masculine, sprawling, a little over the top. Bert was a gracious host, giving us the grand tour, which ended in his wonderful version of a man cave, which was even more masculine than the rest of the house, with a giant bar, pool table, movie theater, and enough dedicated movie star pictures to fill a museum. As I scanned the photos, the inevitable questions popped up. "I see you have a picture of Errol Flynn. He was one of my favorites. You must have met him near the end of his career." "Yeah, but he was still at it," Bert clarified. "I knocked on his dressing room door one day at Warner Brothers, and he casually called me in. I stepped inside, and he's being serviced by a young starlet. He carried on talking like it was nothing, like it happened all the time." Which it did. John Wayne used to invite Bert over all the time because Duke thought he was funny. Richard Pryor also thought Bert was funny, and this was coming from a funny guy. After a concert, Richard invited Bert to ride on his private jet. During the flight, Richard was more than a little amused by the black man giving Whitey a ride on a private jet. Bert could relate stories in a wonderful stream of consciousness from any decade you asked about. He was a great raconteur, and I encouraged him to write a book. "Hell, Bert, I've written a book, and you've been around twice as long as I have. If anyone has a book in them, it's you." Bert did not disagree, and in 2015, I was pleased to see his autobiography hit the shelves. For the most part, the Burn Notice actors got along. Did we have shitty, pissy, or even temperamental moments between us? Hell yes, on numerous occasions. But compared to what I've witnessed on other sets, I'd give us about a B-plus for behavior. What kept the cast grounded enough to grin and bear it through the heat and long hours was the fact that we all respected the end product. It also didn't hurt that the ratings were excellent right out of the gate. Number 2 on the call sheet. Matt Nick shared a theory he had heard about baboons. The number 1 baboon carried the most responsibility, along with the youngest. The top baboon naturally had a lot of stress to make decisions, defend the gang, and lead by example. The youngest baboon also had a lot of stress because he was always being told to keep up and couldn't help being compared unfavorably to all the other baboons. The least stressed, according to Matt, was the number 2 baboon, or me. Being second fiddle, or number 2 on the call sheet, I didn't have to carry the load like Jeffrey Donovan, who was the face of the show. My character added humor and a wink, but Burn Notice did not live or die by me. As a result, I had a pretty damn good time working on the show. Often I would, quote, open the store by being in the first scene filmed to give Jeffrey or Gabrielle some time off, go home for some sun and swim, return hours later, get made up again, and, quote, close the shop by being in the last scene of the day. There were episodes where Sam was all over it, what I called Samtastic episodes, and there were those where he wasn't featured. And the easy episodes, I would make sure to tell the assistant directors to never announce my early departures over the radio, because Donovan would most assuredly hear about it and give me the stink eye all the way back to the production van. The easiest workday I recall had Sam, in a single shot, walking to the end of a driveway, checking his watch, and walking back. About 15 minutes of work. I literally raced off the set that day, urging my driver, Olga, to step on it in case they change their mind. That's not to say that I didn't do my time or put in some gruelingly long hours. As we were shooting on average for 14 hours a day, our call times would get pushed back day by day, and come Friday, with an 11 a.m. crew call, we wouldn't wrap until well into Saturday morning, hence the term Fratterday. There was no shortage of those. Location, location, location. The diversity of Miami continued to enlighten me as production rolled on through the years. As covert do-gooders, we infiltrated virtually every upper-class venue in Dade County. But for every extravagant nightclub, restaurant, marina, and mansion we wormed our way into, we also got stuck in a host of abandoned sugar factories, chemical plants, storage containers, and what I coined shit-wipe alleys. I'm pretty sure we filmed in every abandoned structure in the nearby town of Homestead, which I started to call Homelessstead. I once shot an entire scene in a municipal garage stairwell where the homeless guy camped out on a landing directly beneath me. Like some sort of metropolitan troll, he had rooted himself and refused to move. A crew member assured me, "It's okay, he promised to stay quiet." We even managed to find an abandoned four-story parking garage to shoot in. You'd think a city would always be able to find a use for a vacant parking structure. But this one in Miami was a ghost town. Even the former homeless camps on each level had been vacated. Maybe the building had become unfit or too much of a health hazard to maintain. And if that's the case, why the hell were we filming there? The tricky part was getting up to the set via stairwells choked with decomposing clothing, used syringes, and makeshift toilets. Jimbo was the father of all squatters. In 1954, Jimbo Luznar was evicted from his waterfront shrimp place in downtown Miami. In return, he got a lifetime free lease from the city if he moved to a place on Virginia Key, which was basically a swampy bog across from the sewage treatment plant. Jimbo took the deal, and he kept the city to its word, much to their chagrin, for over 50 years. Jimbo and his two sons, Bubba and Bobby, changed their business model from shrimping to alcohol and maintained one of the funkiest down-and-out bars in the Northern Hemisphere. Over the years, the place began to look like Gilligan's Island, if Gilligan were a drunken crackhead. The truly bohemian vibe attracted every weirdo, drifter, pirate, squatter, and freak in the area. Jimbo's was a visual treat, if decrepit, dangerous island life was what you were after. When we filmed scenes there, the art department rarely had to add any dressing. Obviously, it was perfect, and we weren't alone in our thinking. Jimbo's had been a film location since 1964 when Flipper was shot there, and as recently as The Fast and the Furious. Proximity to the sewage treatment plant gave Jimbo's a wonderful perfumed stench all day long. The treatment plant installed a line of sprayers, emitting some god-awful odor-neutralizing fragrance, but the combination of industrial-strength Febreze and human waste was a bit much on the olfactory senses. I would have preferred the pure smell of crap, honestly. Ultimately, a family squabble ended the long run of Jimbo's place. Burn Notice returned to the site one last time after it had been basically bulldozed and fenced. Oddly enough, as sleazy as Jimbo's was, it was an original, and I was sad to see it go. Cities can be bipolar places, and the history of Miami explains a lot about its spectrum of glamour and grime. We filmed in an area called Coconut Grove, a touristy, ritzy little shopping neighborhood where a person could stroll from the beach to grab an iced latte or a Tommy Bahama shirt. However, if that same person were to walk a couple blocks further, they'd stumble into Little Bahamia, an area that was noticeably poorer. A CVS drugstore on the corner of Grand Avenue and Margaret Street marked a harsh but invisible boundary between relative affluence and abject poverty. I often wondered why there was such a distinct difference between two sides of the same street. After a little research, I found out that much of Coconut Grove was built in the late 1800s by laborers from the Bahamas. Apparently, Bahamians were the best of the best when it came to assembling and maintaining thatched structures. Starting with what was considered one of the first hotels in Florida, the Bahamians kept building. Many of the laborers decided to cut down their commute by literally building their own neighborhood next door. Ironically, many of the Bahamian homes have proven more resilient than the wealthier ones built since. The Caribbean-seasoned Bahamians built their homes low to the ground, so high winds just blew overhead, and they chose yellow pine, a type of wood that termites avoided. Car capers. While in Miami, I wasn't sure which car stunts were more spectacular, the ones on our TV show or the random recklessness I witnessed on the southern Florida streets every day. Driving there was unsettling, since the diverse inhabitants all drove according to the laws of their home countries. On average, once per day, driving back and forth to set, my driver Olga and I would experience what I called holy shit moments, whereby a driver, usually a hopelessly lost tourist from another country, would do the most unexpected or unthinkable maneuver directly in front of us. Whether it was the shirtless dude in flip-flops, flying down the freeway on his Lawrence of Arabia-era motorcycle, weaving in and out of traffic with reckless abandon, or the two ninja motorcycle riders who whizzed past our car on either side, driving in Miami wasn't something you did casually. Add to that a flotilla of scooters, driven often by champagne-swilling out-of-towners, a mostly clueless pedestrian population, and you've got yourself the Wild West of traffic scenarios. Driving to set every day was a great way to prep for our own shenanigans behind the wheel. The character Michael Weston drove a bitchin' black Dodge Charger that became iconic over the life of the show. That car was good news and bad news, all wrapped up into one hot package, hot being the operative word. A black car being blasted with light on an asphalt parking lot in August in Miami is a combination that should never really go together. But there we were, week after week, year after year, filming long dialogue fests inside this 1973 motorized Easy-Bake oven. Mercifully, right around season 3, due to Mr. Donovan's insistence, the AC crisis in the Charger was solved. The transpo department installed a unit that would easily have cooled a tractor trailer. I didn't get to drive the Charger much, but when I did, I always had a blast. 1970s American vehicles, for all of their shitty features, had balls. Anytime I had to peel out after some bad dude, I'd slam that sucker into low gear and lay rubber all the way out of frame. I would routinely get applause from the crew after an action take because that car could make it look easy. Unfortunately, my character Sam drove a different car, a modern Cadillac. Now, not to disparage a great American brand. Look, I grew up in a Chevy family. But modern caddies suck raw eggs. Invariably, Sam would have to stomp on the gas and race out of a shot. Not in the Cadillac. I'd bury that pedal to the floor and the engine would heave before engaging, as if thinking over what it was about to do before it did it.
Bruce, we need you to give it some juice on this next one, the director would invariably radio to me.
I'm juicing. Believe me, this caddy is shooting blanks, man. I tried every trick in the book, turning the AC off, pre-revving and popping into gear, but nothing spun out like the ratty old Charger. Police escorts are a beautiful thing. You can't help but feel presidential as you race down the street, cars parting like the Red Sea before Moses. I got to participate in one such escort when Sam was trying to catch up with some random scumbag. I pretty much had two lanes to myself to race, skid, and swerve, while actual traffic zoomed past me in the opposite side of the road. With cameras strategically placed, the end result looked like I was driving like a maniac in the middle of traffic. I consider Burn Notice to be a contemporary TV show, but in all but one season, our characters never wore seatbelts. Nothing is less sexy than a good guy sliding into his car in hot pursuit than stopping the action cold to buckle up. I am aware of how completely irresponsible it was for us to perpetuate the bad habit of not wearing protective harnesses in large, fast-moving vehicles, but early on, all the actors just jumped in the cars and took off. Realistically, we never had to do any driving that really required seatbelts. When we squealed off in a car, It was only for about 100 feet, or until we were out of the shot. Season 7, the seatbelt thing changed. Enter Hyundai, a sponsor. In Hyundai's cars, drivers had to be safe. So a nervous director approached Gabrielle and me before a scene, sitting in the new Hyundai, ready to do a bit of driving.
Hey guys, when you get in the car this time, we really need you to buckle up. It's a Hyundai sponsorship thing.
Are you fucking kidding us?
Gabrielle asked. She doesn't really sound like that. That's the best I can do. Never one to hide her raw emotions.
Bugger off!
I was more diplomatic, perhaps, but I, too, declined the invitation to buckle up for the shot/sponsor. Neither of us saw any reason to change now. The director gulped and turned away. They filmed the scene as is, but later digitally added seatbelts in several interior shots. Thankfully, I only had to ride in that dumb car once. Law and Disorder. A guy came up to me at a convention recently and said, "Bruce, I suppose for burn notice you have to go to the gun range regularly just to stay on target, right?"
No, I said, correcting him gently. As actors, we never actually have to hit anything.
It's safe to say, being a spy/action show, guns were a big part of burn notice, and guns on set, even if non-lethal, were something you had to pay attention to. Guns shooting fake rounds were still explosive and emitted wadding that was unsafe at close range. Tragically, a few actors have died because of sloppy, albeit fake, gun handling. Charlie, the prop master/gun wrangler, and I forged a great relationship. He was always prepped, professional, and chipper in executing his duties. Charlie and I got along well because he knew I wasn't cavalier about gunplay. I dick around on sets all day long, but not when it comes to cars, stunts, or guns, any one of which can put a person out of commission. Staging gunplay is kind of like choreography. You duck out from behind a wall, fire 3 rounds, and dive back as ricochets pepper the area around you. It's a lot of back and forth. The problems arise when somebody loses count on either end. You don't want to be jumping into the line of fire when an effects guy is shooting bullet hits at your face. These tiny plastic balls are filled with a sparking agent, and when they're shot out of the equivalent of a pellet gun, they shatter into a million pieces. They look great exploding on a brick wall, but aren't so fun when high-velocity sparkle dust and plastic shards are raining down on your moneymaker. Squibs, or body bullet hits, are tricky as well. The mechanical effects guy rigs a thin protective metal plate on wherever an actor's going to get hit, straps a small explosive charge to that, then lays a sealed blood pouch on top of that. Wires are then run down the actor's leg to a power source. On cue, the effects guy hits a button, the charge blows, and the blood is blown across the room in a glorious, gory spectacle. When a person is shot in the front, the real mess is when the bullet comes out the back. But filmmakers tend to ignore that and insist on blood spraying out the front as well. In one scene, Jeffrey is facing an informant, who was to be killed seconds before critical information is shared. It was the climax of an episode, so they milked the hell out of it. At the fateful moment, the actor is shot, the blood flies, and Donovan grabs his face, wincing in pain. That was not part of the script. Needless to say, filming stopped immediately. Anxious crew members and stunt guys rushed to his aid. Jeffrey's upper lip was struck by the wadding blown out of the other actor's shirt and was now the size of a golf ball. I always get the most frightened after a close call like that. What if it was his eye, or gonad, or whatever? That's the star of our show. If he went down, we were all unemployed. Donovan was a trooper and completed the scene, which required him to talk on the phone by hiding his obvious wound with the prop. By all accounts, gun ownership in Miami was very robust, which added to my general malaise. I soon drew the morose conclusion that I would be shot to death in southern Florida. On the job, no less. Why? Because I was Sam Axe, Michael Weston's gun-savvy buddy who was always watching his pal's back. That meant I would routinely be filming scenes that had me carrying rifles and automatic weapons in plain sight. One scene called for me to dump half a dozen automatic weapons into the Miami River. In order to get a dramatic wide shot for the scene, the entire crew, everyone, had to be kept a certain distance away from me, preferably hidden or otherwise out of view. So, for all some local hero knew, I was just some creepo dumping illegal guns.
My sense of dread was much worse when Sam was actually firing weapons. Another scene had me alone, armed with a sniper rifle, situated on top of a four-story building downtown, firing full-load blanks whose powerful report echoed off buildings like canyon walls in an old western. Normally, I would be surrounded by camera equipment, lighting rigs and crew members, but this was also a wide angle. From street level, I was just a lone psycho taking pot shots at pedestrians. I was legitimately concerned that some espresso-fueled off-duty cop or a knee-jerk do-gooder would look up, spot the perpetrator, yell, "Shooter!" and unload his clip of real bullets into me. The good news was that if I had inadvertently started a major shootout, the crew of Burn Notice wouldn't be outgunned. More than a few of them told me on the sly that they were packing heat, just in case. We also had plenty of uniformed police assisting us with blocking roads and rerouting traffic when they were off duty. One of the officers we regularly had on set with us was a robust fellow I nicknamed Taser Ted, a likable guy with a perverse love of tasering perps. Over the course of 7 seasons, Ted often invited me to do a late-night ride-along with him when he was on duty. I never took him up on that offer, but I did enjoy playing certain Tase the Perp games with him in between camera setups. "Okay, Ted," I would begin, "let's say you get a call that I'm in a 7-Eleven, and the pissed-off owner says I refuse to leave. What would you do?" "I'd insist that you leave the store," he replied with an almost eerie tone of control. "Would you give me a time limit or a countdown to leave?" "Nope. I'd ask you to get out of the store now." "Or what?" "I'm going to ask you to get out of the store now," he repeated, this time resting his hand on his namesake taser. Apparently, by that point, I had already disobeyed a direct order from a keeper of the peace, and he could have tased me. But Ted made an effort to remain calm and professional. Pushing his buttons, I always wanted to see what would make him actually draw. "Hey, buddy," my play-acting character responded, "I just want to buy a peanut cluster. I'm a customer." "Well, then buy it and get out." "Well, I haven't decided yet." "Which one?" I loved to torment Ted because I knew he had to put up with jerks like that all day long. But this ad hoc training session was becoming all too real. Ted's face turned red, his hand twitching involuntarily on the taser. "Oh, you know what?" I would balk. "I loved Spree when I was a kid. Maybe I'll get some Spree instead. Zap!" Ted had had enough of my bullshit. He didn't actually tase me, but he often encouraged me to experience it, and I often declined. We blew it. Big time. During the preparations to film Burn Notice, Matt Nix delivered an early and irrevocable edict. There will be no digital explosions on Burn Notice. They all have to be real. Matt's explanation was along the lines of when a car blows up, you see these amazing fire funnels curling up beneath them in the aftermath. No digital guy is going to do something freaky and random like that. Explosions have a mind of their own. And so, it turned out, did the special effects guys. In the course of 7 seasons, we saw and felt some doozies. Writers, directors, and producers could not get enough of blowing the living shit out of everything around us. In the opening credits, one beautiful blast almost blows Jeffrey and me off our feet as we run away from an erupting boat. And how do you really protect yourself from an explosion, anyway? I didn't pack the charge. I don't know how much or even what material they used. Is the guy good with timing? Is he a trigger-happy son of a bitch? Honestly, as far as explosions went, I never knew if I was in any real danger or not. With regard to the deafening noise of explosives, you can always protect your ears with wax plugs, but being part of the shot, I had to hear all the cues distinctly, so I tended to put in just enough wax to dampen a loud blast, but not enough to mask the voice of the stunt coordinator. Of course, there wasn't much to stop a given explosion from launching errant shrapnel into your retreating ass. I guess overall I was thankful to be running away from most explosions. But no matter how much you prep, there are always variables. An explosion once launched a car hood 50 feet into the air, spinning like a giant metallic frisbee of death. Crew members shaded their eyes to track its descent in the blinding sun. One day, I heard they were going to set off a big one just before lunch, so I showed up early to take pictures from a, quote, safe zone. When they called action, I clicked away, but the first shot was tilted sideways from the concussion of the blast. It was only after I regained my balance and composure that I could finish the series of shots. And I was half a football field away. I can't imagine the jolt those stunt folks felt, being so much closer to ground zero. We maxed out explosion-wise at an office complex one day. Usually when you film at a location where gunplay or explosions occur, you issue a memo to residents and nearby businesses, warning them about the noise so nobody becomes alarmed when chaos ensues. I'm sure the leaflets were distributed, but sometimes it's hard to reach every last person. In this case, a massive explosion was to be set off on the second floor of an office building, and it was a whopper. Crew members filming on top of the building reported later that the building actually shook from the impact. Office workers inside hadn't expected the size of the blast, and the people who never even got the memo were convinced that an airplane had struck the building terrorist style. I'm not exaggerating when I say mayhem ensued. In a classic example of timing is everything, one muggy afternoon we blew off a big bertha of an explosion just as Air Force One was departing Miami International Airport. I wondered if more than a few Secret Service guys on board didn't spit out their black coffee when that sucker blew directly beneath their ascending craft. Welcome to Burn Notice, Mr. President. I hope you like the show. And here's a quick aside that is not in the book. When we were in Miami, President Clinton was there doing a fundraiser for Haiti. So we got on the invitation, me and Jeffrey Donovan. And so we thought, okay, let's get in line to meet him. And one of his associates took us aside and he says, hey, if you go near the end of the line, by the time you get to the president, he'll have more time. If you go right up front, he'll have to blow past you and he won't have any time to chat. We thought, okay, well, he won't know us anyway, so it doesn't matter. But we stuck near the end of the line. We got about 20 feet away and we look over at him and we make eye contact and he shouts above the din of people. He goes, hey, I love your show. And literally, me and Jeffrey Donovan looked behind us because we thought there's no way President of the United States watches our show. We look back. Eventually, we get up front, and he shakes our hands, and he knows Jeffrey's name. He knows my name, and he looks at me, and he goes, Sam Axe, that's my favorite character. We're both over the hill warriors. I'm home all week. Hillary's gone all the time, so I watch it. Hey, where's the girl? Of course, he was interested in where Gabrielle was, but that's another story. Send in Mr. Parker, please. Stunt guys are mostly anonymous. You couldn't pick the average one out of a police lineup. That's kind of the idea. Stunt performers do their thing in painful silence, and the actors take most of the credit. It's all part of the movie magic. I'm very happy, however, to shine an appreciative light on my longtime Burn Notice stuntman, Chris Parker. When stunt coordinator Artie introduced us, Chris was a studly, polite man about 20 years my junior. That's just how I like my stunt guys, young and limber. Chris had solid facial features, and he was game for anything. After clearly busting his ass on a fall or some kind of impact, he'd always crack a boyish smile and shoot a thumbs up, no matter how shaky he really felt. I'm very thankful for all the running, jumping, swimming, fighting, and legitimate crazy-ass driving Chris did for me over the course of the show. Chris and the rest of the stunt team all got busier after the cast members refused to be part of any future explosions. We'd had enough. Let the stunt folks handle it, we reasoned. That's what they do. So thanks, Chris, for sweating your nads off and making me look badass for 7 seasons. I hope I can be your dialogue double again someday. Moon over Miami. If you're not chasing international drug runners in a car or shooting at them, you're going to use your fists. With a bunch of action-based entertainment under my belt, I was no stranger to performing fight scenes, but my body wasn't so sure anymore. For my 50th birthday, Ida and I enjoyed a leisurely weekend at Isla Mirada, a swanky spot in the Florida Keys where middle-aged, slightly paunchy guys like me go to relax. Oh, I relaxed all right. I showed up on set the following Monday, loose as a goose, but not loose enough. A scene called for me to fight 2 henchmen. It was all planned, and while we never really fight, actors and stunt guys like to at least show exertion when they go at it. One of my moves was to knee a guy in the face, a sharp, short movement. We did it several different times from several different angles. We basically had it in the can, but they wanted one more take. It always seems to work that way. The additional take rolled, we fought, and as my knee extended to, quote, hit the stunt guy's face, I heard a distinct pop, followed by a sharp pain in my right thigh. Before I could react, the second stunt guy was upon me from behind, all part of the routine. Without thinking, being the good little soldier, I continued with the fight for another beat, flipped the baddie over my right shoulder, and collapsed to the pavement on my back. There was an agonizing beat as the stunt guys halted their routine and looked back at me to see what the problem was. "Should we call cut, Jeremiah?" the director asked. "Yeah," I responded, "and get a van around to take me to the hospital because I can't walk." Getting an MRI done to see the extent of the damage was a comedy of terrors. The nurse saw me lying on my back in front of the tube of doom, right leg bent in the air.
"You'll have to flatten your leg for the MRI."
"I can't straighten my leg."
"You'll have to, otherwise we can't do the MRI.
"Well, what do you suggest? I'm all ears."
"We'll have to strap it down flat."
Beautiful. The MRI proceeded, and the prognosis was not great. I fully tore 2 out of 3 connecting hamstring tendons. In all of my random roughhousing, I had never hurt myself this badly before, and it was as alarming as it was disabling. I literally could not walk or even straighten my right leg. Through the production office, I was referred to a specialist who was also a surgeon. "Hey, so Doc, as you can see, I have a torn hamstring. What are my options here?" "The options are physical therapy or surgery. I recommend surgery. You have a bad tear." Coming from a surgeon, his opinion wasn't a shocker. "Okay, Doc," I asked casually, "if I went down that road, what's involved in reattaching my hamstring?" "Well, first we'd have to move the sciatic nerve." "You can stop right there, Doc. I saw my dad go through that, so no deal. Let me ask you, have you ever torn a hammy?" "I have, actually, windsurfing." "Did you get surgery?" "No, I was young and foolish back then." "Did you go to physical therapy?" "No, I was young and foolish. I'm starting to get that." "Without doing any of that, what percentage would you say that you are back now?" "About 80%. "Then, Doc, sign me up for physical therapy." For the next 10 weeks, I got to know the world of physical therapy, going multiple times a week, grinding it out whenever the shooting schedule would allow. The news that I was released on set was sometimes embarrassing by way of the words used. Oscar, our intrepid first assistant director, would bark over the walkie-talkie,
"Bruce Campbell's released. He's going to rehab."
I'd always jump in immediately to correct him. No, Oscar. It's physical therapy, not rehab. Whatever you called it, the burn notice production marched on unabated. Since I could still sit and talk without impediment, and all the signs of injury were disguised under my pant leg, I was back on set 36 hours later, sitting in a car talking with Gabrielle. For the rest of that episode, I leaned, or had a foot up, or was sitting every time you saw me. By the end of shooting, our director Jeremiah could have subsequently published a Filming Actors with Disabilities manual from what he learned about faking the shots with me. As I slowly got better, I could stand in scenes again and do simple, smaller movements. The next episode was directed by Tim Matheson, and he fully adapted to my lessened abilities. There was a big moment during his episode when I had to walk across the set, imploring Michael Weston to listen to reason. The entire take, as I gingerly made my way forward, all I could think was, "Come on, hamstring, don't fail me now." As the weeks went by, I gradually got limited strength, stability, and flexibility back. It was a huge relief, and I gave my Miami pool a lot of credit. I'd always loved swimming, but now the pool was a necessity. Floating in water took most of the weight off my leg. It also slowed down and smoothed out my movements, which was very appealing. The chances of getting re-injured in the pool were practically nil, apart from getting in and out on slick tile. The real test came about 4 weeks later when my character had to fight Jeffries. Donovan was great about it all, being careful to avoid certain danger zones, and we broke the fight into enough pieces to avoid any real strain. For my part, it was a relief to be able to complete enough moves to at least be convincing in the scene. It meant that I was on the mend. In retrospect, I feel that doing 10 weeks of intensive physical therapy was enough to do the trick, and I highly recommend the process if you ever bash yourself or tear something bad. Thankfully, 10 years later, I can still do most anything now that I could do before the injury, and the old sciatic nerve remains intact. Offset. Time, weather, and schedule permitting, Kobe and I would hang out after hours watching some of the 37 Lawrence Welk episodes I had recorded on PBS. Yes, Lawrence Welk. People ask me, Bruce, why the hell do you watch Lawrence Welk? Isn't that show for people over 85? My answer is long and circuitous, but Lars is entertaining on multiple levels. The show ran on U.S. television from 1952 to 1982 and became a staple of, quote, wholesome American entertainment on Saturday nights. Lawrence himself was an accomplished band leader, and his cartoonish accent was a broad imitation of the immigrants he grew up with in North Dakota. The weekly Lawrence Welk show, considered, quote, embarrassing and grueling by Ida, who was forced to watch it as an unruly teenager, was so relentlessly square it was hip, so tragically unfunny it was hilarious. You get my meaning? When Kobe and I laughed ourselves senseless, it wasn't because of a scripted joke. With hokey dance numbers, costumes from Planet Polyester, and old-timey musical themes, the whole show was kind of a joke. Because Lawrence Welk ran for so many decades, fashion historians everywhere can rejoice that 30 years' worth of skinny ties, bouffant hairdos, long sideburns, and bell-bottoms are preserved forever for our viewing pleasure. To round out our after-hours viewing, we added the occasional Soul Train episode, which was the funk version of Lawrence Welk, or a T.J. Hooker rerun. As an actor in his mid-50s doing Burn Notice, I couldn't take my eyes off of William Shatner, also in his mid-50s on T.J. Hooker. What was he up to when he was that age? What did he look like? Did he do his own stunts? It turned out that he kind of did. In fact, Bill repeatedly executed what I have since called the Shatner power slide. Anytime Bill's character had to arrive at a crime scene on T.J. Hooker, his squad car would race up and screech to a smoky halt. The shot would continue and, without editing, Bill would step out of the car, which meant that he had done it without the aid of a stuntman or an editor. I was always impressed by that and mentioned it the first time I met him in the green room at a Wizard World Comic-Con convention a few years ago. You know, the producers didn't want me to do that, Bill added, with obvious delight at the recollection. Too dangerous, they said. I wouldn't have let you do those either, I said. How does one actually pull that kind of slide off? Shatner looked over his shoulder quickly, like he was still keeping this a secret. I got with the stunt guys, and they feathered the emergency brake so it wouldn't catch. It's a 4-part maneuver as you come to your mark. Foot off the gas. Pull the emergency brake. Steer. Foot on the actual brake to stop. Counterintuitively, you can still steer when the emergency brake is on. If you follow the first 3 steps, by the time you hit the actual brake, the car will come to a dead stop. I was particularly thankful to Bill for that little tidbit, as I was asked to perform just such a maneuver in the pilot of Ash vs. Evil Dead. Ash was supposed to pull his hulking Delta up to a dive bar and skid sideways. I smiled at Sam as he explained the scene. Don't worry, pal. I got this. I recently won a Saturn Award for Ash vs. Evil Dead and ran into William Shatner at the event. It was the first time I had seen him since his advice, and I was able to dedicate my award to him and the Shatner power slide. Thanks, Bill. Wheeling and dealing. When I was a kid, my universe wasn't divided into nations or continents. It was divided into neighborhoods, the largest geographical division I could imagine. The expansion of my universe was only made possible by the advent of the bicycle. Once Burn Notice was picked up as a series, I knew I had to plan for what could be a long haul. Production had taken over a massive former performance center on Dinner Key, the one where Jim Morrison infamously attempted to, quote, free Willie in concert. So the place has some history, albeit questionable. This leaking, molding, million-square-foot building became our makeshift studio for 7 years. A handful of permanent sets were erected, Michael Weston's loft, Fiona's apartment, Madeline's house among them. A small fleet of Dodge Chargers, fake cop cars, and burned-out wrecks packed the place to the gills. Based on the way everything was laid out, Cast trailers positioned outside were actually quite a schlep from the interior sets. Considering the debilitating heat, I looked for a quick, easy way to crisscross the campus. On official studio backlots, bicycles are everywhere, driven by maintenance folks, delivery people, and even security guards. They are emission-free, make no noise, and don't clog tight roadways. I decided to get bicycles for the cast, so I bought 4 single-gear beach cruisers, each with old-school back-pedal brakes. At first, the crew chuckled derisively whenever the thespians rode to set. They stopped laughing after a couple weeks of 16-hour days as we pedaled past, breeze in our hair, while they trudged along on concrete-impacted feet. Gabrielle and I played our own version of Marco Polo with our bike bells. Whenever the mood hit me, I'd flick the bell with my thumb. Shing, shing. If Gabrielle was within earshot, she'd return the call with a dink-donk. For years, riding back and forth to various sets and locations, we played this silly game. Shing, shing, dink-donk. Shing, shing, dink-donk. And that silly game made us laugh every time. Overall, I bought something like 14 different bikes during the run of Burn Notice. Most of them were part of my ever-growing home fleet for visiting dignitaries, but a few got stolen and had to be replaced. Donovan's bike didn't even make it a year before it went missing in a daring daylight raid. Some schmo strolling right through our base camp spotted the bike propped up against his trailer and simply rode off with it. Over the course of the show, 2 of my own bikes were also stolen, so it was a bit of a revolving door at the Coral Gables bike shop. They smiled each time I came in. Not because of the TV show, but because they knew I was going to buy another bike. Some random advice. Ditch the cable lock. U-shaped locks are the only way to go. I haven't had any bikes stolen since. Cycling started out as an on-set utility, but it was really a pleasant reintroduction to something I loved as a child. Even though Oregon is an incredible place for outdoor recreation, I never really did much cycling back home. Living in the foothills of the Siskiyou Mountains, I was always going up a hill or down a hill, pedaling too hard or not at all. Florida, however, was F-L-A-T, flat. While you're riding leisurely, the man-made breeze was a great way to inadvertently mitigate the humidity. Cycling became a rekindled hobby. To my delight, I discovered extensive car-free bike paths nearby, so epic zen-like rides were planned often with the likes of Ida, Kobe, guest stars, or random writers and directors. Producers got to join in too, but only if they paid for lunch. It was amazing how many of these participants hadn't been on a bicycle in years, because they still considered them toys, associated strictly with childhood. I guess I was one of those people, but thanks to Burn Notice and the wonderful flatness of Florida, I still jump on my bike to explore new sections of my expanding universe whenever I can.
Ode to Foxes.
I love dive bars. I always have. Fancy bars are all well and cool, but I'm not an attitude guy or a hipster, so I tend to avoid anything with too much chrome or too little atmosphere. I'm not sure how I first stumbled across Foxes. Likely it was during a local bicycle outing. The exterior was very nondescript, as the best places are, except for the outline of a fox and a martini glass. I immediately knew it would be my kind of place because it was almost pitch black inside. For the first 10 minutes after entering, you have to let your eyes adjust from the bright Florida sun. Fox's Chiron Inn, right on the edge of Dixie Highway, had been around since 1946 and sported a well-worn S-curved bar. The bar stools were raised captain's chairs that swiveled, and I'm sure all the old nautical types who frequented the place felt at home. Fox's was a prime rib kind of place, with decent grub and a larger-than-you-would-imagine menu. But Fox's was all about the atmosphere and the hooch. My favorite libation was slash is a Patron Silver tequila martini. My favorite bartender in the world, Margot, served the martinis with a sidecar, a mini carafe of extra pourings kept cold in its own miniature bucket. After a long day shooting bad guys, nothing was more enjoyable than to ride the two-wheeler to Fox's and listen to the regulars' bullshit. Fox's was all about regulars. Larry and Terry and Ken and about half dozen others who would make their way over at 4 o'clock, the beginning of happy hour. Sociologically speaking, it was interesting to see the same group of guys sit in the same chairs at the same time for years on end. I learned quickly about the territory of old-time bars and their patrons. I made the mistake of invading their space one day, albeit unwittingly, and got the stink eye from Margot.
Better not sit there, hon.
Oh, I said innocently.
That's where Larry sits. He likes his seat.
Got it. Where's safe? Margot directed me a few stools down, outside of the regular zone. I got to know the regulars fairly quick, and they were nice enough, but they didn't really open up or fully acknowledge my existence until I had been going there for about 6 months.
You're not a tourist, are you?
Larry asked one day, squinting at me in the dark. No, sir, I'm here working on a TV show.
Oh.
That's all Larry had to say about it. He wasn't impressed with Hollywood or anything else. Larry and the gang pretty much made fun of everything all the time. Everyone was an idiot. The world was going to hell. The difference was that these guys always had a smile on their faces. They never got too grim. I never knew what half of them did or what their personal lives were like, but I also didn't care. That's what I like about local dive joints. Nobody cares about any of that. All they care about is getting away from whatever it is they do, sitting with like-minded folks, and forgetting about life for a while. Margot was the captain of Fox's ship. She was the day bartender, and she looked the part. A longtime Florida resident, she had shaggy blondish hair, a little too much sun complexion, and the rasp of a smoker. She had a great sense of humor, which helped modulate the sometime mercurial moods of the regulars. Margot also poured a mean drink. Her trick was never to measure. These days, the second I see a bartender fish out the one-ounce stainless cup to measure my drink, I already know it'll be a crappy pour. Margot was also the type who would slip you a little extra if you and the boys were having an extra fun afternoon. Some would call that pushing the envelope. I call it customer service. Over the years, with some degree of practice, I've broken down the various types of pours one gets at various establishments. A generally crappy pour is called a piss pour or pauper's pour. Bowling alleys pour a lot of these. A pour that you would get at, say, Applebee's would be a corporate pour. A substantial pour is a presidential pour. A dictatorial pour is where the bartender is serving a dictator with a gun to his head so he just keeps pouring. I caught Foxes at the ass end of a long run. The standards-only jukebox gave up about a year after I started going there, and management changed hands a couple of times. When the Southern Florida college crowd started seeping in for the kitsch factor, I knew the end was near. Fox's is officially closed now. I don't miss it because I was part of it. And, as Margot knows, I certainly had my fill.
Chapter 15. To Iraq and Back. Not to be dismissive, but I didn't know Iraq from a hole in the ground. As a young adult, I remember the long gasoline lines and something about an oil embargo and Iran, but that's as close as Iraq got to my consciousness. It was a vague, distant land. We've all heard the cradle of civilization thing, but what does that mean? About a quarter century later, my brother Don got a little closer to that neck of the woods. He served in the first Gulf War of 91, and because of his military police background, guarded Iraqi prisoners in Kuwait. This was just after Saddam's troops were pushed out and all the oil wells were torched. A new soldier to the environmentally disastrous area asked Don when the sun was going to come up. Don reminded him that it was 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I knocked on the back door of Iraq in 2004. The location for my undisputed American classic, Man with the Screaming Brain, was in Bulgaria, just two countries away. But it wasn't like after shooting I could hop a puddle jumper to Baghdad and see what was going on. You didn't just go there. 5 years later, as I was sitting on the burn notice set with star Jeffrey Donovan, the subject of Iraq came up again. Two active duty servicemen had visited that day and informed us that the show was very popular with the armed forces. Mr. Donovan, I called him that on set to keep him calm, and I began to engage in slightly more than idle chit-chat. We talked about the wars all the time and were both up on current events, but the conversation was now more like, okay, so what can we actually do to help? We're just actors. Should we go over there and visit the troops, you think? That would be crazy. We agreed that we would go if they would have us, and put the feelers out through Brad, the PR guy at USA Studios.
Life moved on. Donovan and I went back to work. It's easy to forget about things when your brain is boiling in its own tropical stew. About a week later, word came down from Armed Forces Entertainment that they would be delighted to have us. Donovan and I shared the same immediate reaction. Shit. We really have to go now, don't we? I said, half asking. Yeah, we do, Jeffrey nodded. With an inexplicable